Way down there at the center of life are machines that manufacture the stuff of life. Those machines lead us to ask, can we find viable replacements for non-viable antibiotics?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1093rd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in sunny Portofino who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. How are we doing, Jason?
Pleasure to roll with today.
Good to go. Intern producer Olivia Duncan. Hello, Olivia.
Morning.
Also, folks, I ran across an article of news a short while ago about a University of California Santa Cruz professor who won a $3 million breakthrough prize for research into the workings of ribosomes. Now, what really captured my attention was the thought expressed by the prize-winning Professor Harry Knoller that he might be using the money to help develop his home garden. Now, that really attracted my attention, and I just got to wondering, what on earth is a ribosome anyway? And so get ready out there to take off on a journey way down to the center of life, where we will explore the mechanisms of cells and meet the ribosomes of which we wonder, and learn how they manufacture the stuff of life, and ask the real big question, can ribosomes help us find viable replacements for non-viable antibiotics? And boy, our guide for this break for this journey is our breakthrough prize-winning Harry Knoller, professor emeritus of molecular biology, not just biology but molecular biology, at the University of California Santa Cruz. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Now, how goes your garden?
Well, right now it's covered with ice.
Ice. Bonnie Doon, it's kind of cold this time of year, isn't it? So you have a lot of titles here. Professor Emeritus of MCD Biology. Professor Emeritus, that means you're so valued they can't get rid of you.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Good.
So, Formally, I'm retired, but the research is so exciting and fun and intriguing that they're letting me stay around, and we're continuing to do research.
And you're the director of the Center for Molecular Biology of RNA at the university.
Correct.
So you're still allowed to hang around. They encourage you to hang around, participate in this exciting new. What is exciting about it to you?
Well, the Center for Molecular Biology of RNA is actually the largest group of RNA scientists in the world, and it's the most prominent collection of people working on RNA, and we are looking at every aspect of RNA science there, from RNA genomics to the study of regulatory RNAs, functional RNAs, RNA structure, and RNA biology at all levels.
Are you like a kid in a candy store?
Absolutely.
Having all kinds of fun. You know, one of the things that attracted to me was I took my little article of news into the adjoining office here at the radio station where an associate, Carol Stafford, is understanding of such issues. And I said, "This make any sense to you?" And she said, "Oh, he's one of my favorite professors." And she told me the story of how you were lecturing class one day and a spider happened to crawl across the lens of your projector. And you put everything aside and started telling stories about the spider. And she said it was one of the most fascinating lectures she's ever heard. So I thought, I'll bet if there's anybody who could tell us about ribosomes, it's somebody who could lecture about an occasional spider that happens across the lens of the projector. So happy to have you aboard. You're a researcher and an instructor. Which was the most fun to you?
Well, they're both great fun. Mm-hmm. Interacting with bright, excited students. is always fascinating and rewarding, and taking them into the lab and watching them become scientists is an amazing experience.
So you get to see their curiosity become focused, and the focus giving the young folks direction.
Yeah, and things starting to happen in their experiments, and then I get excited, and they get excited, and they become addicted, and it can be a lifelong experience.
And you got addicted someplace along the line way back there, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Well, my dad and mom were terrific. Neither one of them had gone to college, but they were bright people and very encouraging and supportive. My dad took me to observatory, the Chabot Observatory up in the Oakland Hills, where the public could go and look at planets and so on through the powerful telescopes up there. We lived in West Berkeley. One day he pointed up in the Berkeley Hills, and he said, see that round building up there? That's the cyclotron. That's where they split the atom. And I thought, wow, because, you know, it was just after the war and the atomic bomb and all this kind of stuff. People gave me chemistry sets for Christmas, and, you know.
You were out there in the back porch making stink bombs, right?
Well, I remember my mom coming home and discovering the aftermath of an explosion in her kitchen one afternoon, and that was the end of my kitchen laboratory.
But someplace along the line, you went to school, you became a PhD, Oregon, I think, right?
That's right.
Right. But somehow you latched onto this notion of ribosomes. Do you remember when that you remember that moment you said, there's something here?
Well, ribosomes sounded really intriguing to me from the first time I heard about them. They translate the genetic code by reading a messenger RNA, essentially an RNA copy of a gene. And it was clear that they had to move along the messenger RNA, reading one codon at a time, translating it into protein. I thought, God, they must be like a little muscle. They have to be moving. So that intrigued me. And then I went to Cambridge for England for my postdoc, my first postdoc, and I was at a sherry party, a guy I had met in Berkeley, completely unrelated to science, Tony Tanner. He had become head of English studies at King's College in Cambridge and invited me to this party, and I was overwhelmed by all the brilliant people at the party. The dumbest person in the room seemed to be 10 times smarter than anybody I'd ever met in my life. And in the middle of this, probably the smartest person in Cambridge walked over to me. His name was Sidney Brenner. He was later to receive a Nobel Prize for molecular biology, one of the founders of molecular biology. And he came up to me and asked me what I was doing, who I was and what I was doing, and I told him I was working on a metabolic protein at the time. And he said, he was very blunt, he said, "That's stupid. If you're a protein chemist, why don't you work on something interesting like the ribosome?" And, you know, I was shell-shocked, but I couldn't get this out of my head.
Did he say why it was interesting?
Well, I knew why it was interesting, but but he was right, and I couldn't get this out of my head, and I started asking people about the ribosome, who's working on ribosomes, and somebody told me, oh, Alfred Tissier in Geneva is starting a group to work on ribosomes. I wrote to Alfred Tissier, is there any possibility you need a protein chemist? And he wrote back by return mail, and that was before the days of email, when can you get here? And so I moved to Geneva from Cambridge and started working on the ribosome, and never looked back.
Well, we're certainly not going to look back. We're going to look way down to the center of life, way down there inside cell, and we're going to check out these little things called ribosomes. They say they are machines. How can they be machines in our bodies? This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, Harry Noller, Professor Emeritus of Molecular Biology, University of California, right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And with Professor Emeritus of MCD Biology, Harry Noller. Well, one of the fascinating things I was talking about during the break was Professor Noller saw something in the ribosome. What is the ribosome, by the way?
Ribosome is the molecular machine that makes proteins in every living organism.
You call it a machine.
It is a machine, yes. It has moving parts. The ribosome is, by our standards, tiny. By molecular standards, it's huge. It's about a millionth of an inch in diameter. And there are hundreds of thousands of them in every cell in your body. They make protein by reading the genetic code, the information in the messenger RNA, which is a transcript of the information in the DNA. So in life, we have essentially two kinds of language. There's the language of DNA and RNA, the language of nucleic acids. And then there's the language of proteins, amino acids. So the ribosome is, you might say, bilingual. It translates between the language of DNA and RNA into the language of proteins. And the ribosome itself is composed of RNA and protein. Most of the functional molecules in life are made out of protein. And so one of the intriguing things was, why is the ribosome made out of RNA and protein? In fact, it's about 50 to 60% RNA. This was a puzzle. And it was assumed that the RNA in the ribosome was a kind of molecular scaffold to hang the proteins, and the proteins were the functional entities of the ribosome.
They had all the smarts, right?
They had all the smarts, and they carried out the job. So, and this is true in almost every aspect of biology, that the proteins are the functional molecules that do everything. Their metabolism, they digest your food, they carry out chemical reactions, biochemical reactions in the body. They make RNA, they make DNA, But in the case of making protein, you had this thing that was itself made out of RNA. So what the hell was going on? And when I came here to Santa Cruz, I considered myself a sort of protein chemist, enzymologist, somebody who worked on proteins. And right, there are more than 50 proteins in the ribosomes. So as a starting my own lab as a young scientist, I thought, well, we'll find some interesting proteins in there that have something to do with making proteins and figure out what they do. And so we started trying to figure out which ones are interesting by throwing chemicals at the ribosome that would modify the proteins, essentially to knock them out. And by reconstitution and so on, we would be able to figure out which ones they were and what they were doing. To my great disappointment, nothing happened. The ribosome bounced back like a rubber ball. Whatever we threw at it, it just said, you know, show me something else. So finally, we hit the ribosome with one chemical that knocked it out. And then when we did the reconstitution test to see what we knocked out, we were surprised to see that the RNA of the ribosome was functionally affected. And at the time, this was greatly disappointing because I knew nothing about RNA. I was a protein chemist. and so finally, I said, well, let's intentionally modify the RNA and see what happens. And we did that, and the ribosome dropped dead. And at this point, I said, uh-oh. And we went back and took several more approaches to that, finally demonstrating that we had indeed functionally modified the RNA. That is, that it, from our experiments, the ribosome was telling us that it was not about the proteins, it was about the RNA. So the RNA of the ribosome was actually the functional part.
This is the breakthrough.
It was, and it didn't feel like it at the time. It felt like we were doing something terribly wrong.
Torturing RNA, right? Torturing the ribosomes.
And I was invited eventually to give a talk at UC Berkeley for the biochemistry department and presented this work. After my talk, my host and I were walking to dinner, and he said, well, I have to tell you, a distinguished member of our department was at your talk, and his reaction was, what a crackpot idea. So that was the welcome that we got from the scientific community.
Well, and they, of course, were holding on to the notion that it was the proteins that did all the work.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, one thing that I ran across when looking into this subject was that there was a time when I think you called it the RNA time, or the
RNA world.
The RNA world, yeah. What is the RNA world?
Well, so we were not alone in thinking about the functional role of ribosomal RNA. It turns out that around the time I came to Santa Cruz, 1968, there was a paper in the Journal of Molecular Biology written by none other than Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the double helix of DNA, and one of the great scientific minds of the 20th century. And he had written a paper talking about the origin of protein synthesis and about the origin of the ribosome and the genetic code. And he pointed out a very important paradox, that if it was the proteins of the ribosome that were important for its function, how could the ribosome ever have evolved? If it was a chicken or the egg problem.
Yeah.
Who was making the ribosomal protein? So he said in that paper, is it possible that the first ribosomes were made purely of RNA? Okay. So, and that, I think, 40 years later, is not only possible, I think it's inescapable.
A world without DNA.
A world without DNA or protein.
Or protein.
So we started thinking about
this. That's an awful small world then, isn't it?
Well, it's a very different world for sure. So RNA is like DNA in that it can carry genetic information. And in fact, there are viruses whose genomes are not made of DNA but RNA. For example, the common cold virus, the flu virus, HIV virus, have RNA genomes. They carry their genetic information in RNA. So you can replicate RNA just like DNA through its double-stranded form.
Wow. And that's what we'll do. We'll replicate those when we get back from this break with Dr. Harry Noller, Professor Emeritus, Molecular Biology, University of California. And you, stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. Today we're heading a different direction. We're heading toward the center of life, way, 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 way down there in the cellular level, looking inside the cell at some of the interesting things that are happening. And one of the most interesting things that's happening is with the smallest element of the, I think it is the smallest element of the cell. Doctor, is it one of the smallest? It certainly looks like it in all the illustrations I've seen, the ribosome.
Well, the ribosome, if you're a molecule, the ribosome is like the Death Star. I mean, it's huge. It's so a water molecule has a molecular weight of 18. The ribosome has a molecular weight of 2.5 million.
Oh,
so it's
a big thing.
It's a big thing at the molecular scale, but
a small thing.
It's a millionth of an inch in diameter. So to us, it's essentially invisible without an electron microscope.
So you were fixed on this notion that it was the RNA in the ribosome that was transforming life.
That the ribosomal RNA was at the heart of the function of the ribosome. In other words, the job of protein synthesis was actually being carried out by RNA, not by protein. It was a very heterodox notion at that time, and we met with a lot of resistance. The upside of it was that since nobody else believed this, we didn't have much competition for about 10 years. But finally, about a decade after our first experiments, people started discovering catalytic RNAs, that is, RNAs that could carry out the job of enzymes. And this was revolutionary, and it suddenly people started believing our work, we started getting much greater acceptance for what we were doing. So at that point, then it became clear that RNA was capable of carrying out genetic information, that you could replicate RNA like you can DNA through a double-stranded intermediate, double helical intermediate, and that RNA could carry out biochemical reactions like protein enzymes. So here you had the three main functions of life, that is the ability to carry genetic information and replicate the catalytic activity of enzymes, plus the machine-like properties of things like the ribosome. So you could now imagine that life could have existed purely run by RNA, that you didn't need DNA, you didn't need proteins. And we started thinking, well, maybe there was an RNA world before our form of life, from which our modern form of life emerged. And this would have been about 3.5 billion years ago.
Give or take. And when people, you talk about your research, you say our research, which indicates to me that you think of yourself as a member of a team here. And yet for a long time, good decade or so, your team was working with the rest of the world looking at you like you were, well, you know, what the heck are those guys in Santa Cruz up to anyway? And that must have been tough work, holding a team together.
Well, we knew that what we were doing was not crazy.
Were not crazy, right?
We knew, and our grants continued to be funded, and our papers continued to be published. And at the heart of it is, if you do your experiments properly, believe your data. And that's really our mantra at the base of everything. Believe your data. If you do a carefully designed controlled experiment and you get a surprising result, listen to it.
Believe the data. Yeah. So you knew you were on to something because the data was telling you you were on to something.
Yes, and we collaborated also with Carl Woese at the University of Illinois, who I think made one of the most important discoveries of the 20th century, which was the discovery of the third kingdom of life, the archaea. And he believed in the origins of life in an RNA world also. So there were a few of us, a handful of us, like a sort of almost an underground movement in biology. And we used to say, well, there was an RNA world, and RNA invented DNA, RNA invented protein.
RNA invented DNA?
Yes.
And then?
And protein.
And protein.
So we can't prove that, but it's right now it's the most plausible explanation for where our form of life came from. RNA is a wonderful molecule with that can do everything that DNA can. However, RNA is very unstable, chemically unstable. So it easily breaks down, it hydrolyzes in the presence of water and at high temperatures and so on, whereas DNA is much more stable, and it only differs from RNA by a single oxygen atom. So you can easily imagine how RNA came, or DNA came from RNA. In fact, that's how DNA is made today. You start out with a piece of RNA, and you convert it to a piece of DNA, and from that piece, you then build up the DNA chain. And so we believe that's where DNA originated. And similarly, we believe that RNA created protein by the beginnings of the ribosome. And we think that the reason the ribosome emerged was not to make protein originally, but to make little pieces of protein that stuck to the RNA to help the RNA fold into new three-dimensional shapes and to carry out new kinds of biochemical reactions. And so the protein, little pieces of protein, piggybacked on the RNA to help it function. And then they grew and eventually took off on their own and became proteins.
Wow. Okay, and when we get back from this quick break, we're going to talk a little bit about what all of this means to all of us out here on the street. These professors working in their laboratory with their test tubes in their microscopes, and what does it mean for us? Well, it means a great big deal. If you stay tuned, you'll learn all about it. This is The Food Chain. Wilson, Dr. Harry Noller, and you.
And now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
More. I just have to ask, Dr. Noller, what do ribosomes eat?
What do ribosomes eat?
Yes.
They eat amino acids. They turn them into protein. So by linking amino acids together...
In their digestive tract, as it were?
So to speak. They don't just take amino acids. They take amino acids connected to a transfer RNA, which are smaller RNAs than the ribosomal RNAs. And the transfer RNAs recognize the codons in the messenger RNA, and then the ribosome connects the amino acids in the transfer RNAs one to the next and connects them into the protein chain. And so as the protein chain grows, the ribosome moves the messenger RNA and the transfer RNAs along like an assembly line. And eventually the protein chain is completed when the ribosome encounters a stop sign in the messenger RNA and then clips the growing polypeptide chain or protein chain off of the tRNA and releases it. The protein folds up into its three-dimensional shape and becomes a functional protein.
Simple as that, folks. Easy as can be. So you're working up there in the university with your team. You're making this incredible breakthrough discovery. When did people start looking at you differently?
Well, probably when I started cutting my hair shorter. eventually they, you know, we just kept at it. One thing led to another. Our initial discovery that we were hitting a crucial part of the ribosomal RNA that was functional led us to ask where were we hitting the ribosomal RNAs? And these are very big RNAs, 1,500 to 3,000 nucleotides long, and we were hitting just single nucleotides within these, and that led us to sequencing around these sites. That led us to ask what the sequence of the whole RNA was, and we determined that. And then we asked, well, how does the ribosomal RNA fold into three dimensions? And we began that. We determined what's called the secondary structure of the ribosomal RNAs, and this led us to ask how do they finally fold into their tertiary or three-dimensional structure? How do the proteins attach to them? What does the three-dimensional structure of the ribosome look like? And so this is in our little lab in Santa Cruz attacking the largest molecular structure that anyone had ever seriously attempted to determine. At this point, some Russian scientists, Marat and Gulnara Yusupov, contacted me from Europe wanting to know if we were interested in doing some crystallography on a part of the ribosome, a sort of small piece of the ribosome. And I wrote back and said, well, why don't we do the whole thing? And so they came to Santa Cruz, and we discovered a new crystal form of the ribosome, so you can actually crystallize ribosomes. And from this, you can determine molecular structure through a process called X-ray crystallography. And this is by shining X-rays on crystals. They diffract into patterns of spots, and then by a mathematical transformation called Fourier transform, you can calculate the three-dimensional structure, which we did around 1999-2000. And so for the first time, we could see the three-dimensional structure of the ribosome, and this was an incredibly exciting moment, and we could see indeed that it was the ribosomal RNA that was in contact with the messenger RNA, the transfer RNAs, and actually catalyzing the synthesis of proteins from the amino acids.
Well, you know, there's a lot of discussion as to whether science should have a practical purpose or whether it should just be figuring out how things work and letting it go at that. But there is a tremendous practical element to the research you've been doing, and we got to take our last break here. But when we come back, I'd like to give us a thumbnail about the tremendous practical application involved in your research and your team's research on the ribosome, that little tiny thing that actually is a great big thing. I guess it all depends on how you're seeing things. If you're looking at it from our perspective, it's way, way down there at the center of life. But if you're looking at it up from the other side, it's a great, big, huge, giant molecule called a ribosome. And what it does is it's a machine that manufactures proteins, which, of course, is the stuff of life. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, Professor Harry Noller, Professor Emeritus of biology, molecular biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a guy who broke through. He broke through.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, so much to say and so little time to say it. So sorry, all you out there who wanted to pick up your phone and call. I guess I hogged the whole thing myself because it's been so much fun. Dr. Noller, there is a practical application to your work and to the ribosome. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the thing we know about ribosomes is that the average person is when you take antibiotics, there's a good chance that what you're doing is attacking the bacterial ribosome, the ribosomes of the bacteria, the pathogenic bacteria that are infecting you. There are small differences between bacterial ribosome structures and human ribosome structure, so that there are chemicals that bind to the bacterial ribosome that will prevent them from functioning, that will jam their machinery, so to speak, that are unable to bind to our ribosomes. And so that's the crucial difference, and that is what makes an antibiotic. It's something that kills the bacterium but doesn't kill the patient. And this has been very effective in curing bacterial diseases, to the point where we have gotten lazy and used to just taking antibiotics for infections. The problem being that bacteria are smart. They know how to mutate into resistant forms that are no longer susceptible to the antibiotic. And this has become especially problematic in recent years with the emergence of so-called super bugs that are resistant not only to an antibiotic but to a huge range of antibiotics, so that multi-drug resistant organisms are now killing people. And one great line of attack against this is to look at the structure of the bacterial ribosome, which we can see down to the atomic level now, and based on how we understand the binding of antibiotics to bacterial ribosomes, design new ones, and this is now being done, and it's working, and so new synthetic antibiotics are starting to emerge that will kill these superbugs. So we have a chance to dig our way out of this problem that we've created over the last decades.
And there it is, folks. We have created a problem. We've done some significant research and way down there at the center of life, thanks to people like Dr. Harry Knowler, breakthrough prize winner in biochemistry with his work on the ribosome. Dr. Knowler, thank you so much for joining us. What fun. Wow. And thank you all for tuning in out there. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.